Welcome to Pediatric Insight, where we have candid conversations with members of the Child Health Advisory Council and some of the nation's top academic child health leaders. I am Wesley Milliken, CEO of Career Physician, and your host. Each conversation addresses a leadership challenge or opportunity that's top of mind for today's pediatric leaders. The council breaks it down based on the wisdom and experience obtained throughout their distinguished careers. And now, I'm honored to turn it over to the moderator in today's conversation.
Thank you for joining us for today's Pediatric Insight. My name is Bruder Stapleton. Council members joining us today for this discussion are Craig Hillemeyer, Daniela Rocarina, Valerie Opapari, Bruce Rubin, Bob Sowen, and Arnie Strauss, along with Wesley Milliken and John Hayes. Today's topic of conversation about the issue of recruitment when your leader to a position, the boss that you would have as a new faculty member or chair, is in an interim or acting situation, so that it's not a permanent leader that you will be reporting to necessarily. This is a very common situation. Older studies showed that the tenure of a dean was about 3 to 4 years, and the latest data I could find it's about 10 years old, is that the median length of time a dean sits in her or his office is 6 years, and the average is 4 years. And that every year now, the AAMC reports there are about 12 new deans appointed to medical schools across the United States. So it's quite common. In terms of chairs, I published a couple of articles a number of years ago that showed that the turnover rate was around 17%. And more recently, in 2022, AMSPDEC published data that showed that there are about 15 new chairs appointed every year, meaning, and there's a 12% turnover every year among pediatric chairs. So it's quite common that an individual may be recruited to a position where the leader is uncertain. Now, in terms of faculty looking at division head roles, there I could find no data with actual numbers related to that. So I kind of put my head together and said, if there are roughly 145 American medical schools, and if we said that, if I said that there are at least 15 divisions in almost every department, or there are more in some, less in some. And Tina Chang published an article in the APA journal, or Academic Medicine, that said that the turnover in general academic pediatrics was quite similar to that of chairs. That would mean that there are roughly between 250 and 400 division heads that are interim every year. That's a lot of people, and recruitment and the workforce shortage we have is so significant. This means that almost, you know, it's a daily occurrence that someone's being recruited where they don't know their chair. So maybe Danielle, you know, what should someone think about when they're looking at a chair and the dean's in interim or acting situation?
Well, thank you, Bruder, for raising an important question. So as I thought about this, again, I probably would start at the top. There are many reasons for seeking a position as chair, right? So obviously the candidate needs to be well prepared with what their vision is and the reasons that they want to actually achieve the position as chair. But so there are several things to consider. One might be generally the climate of that institution. So when you join an institution, and whether you have been part of that community in which you have great knowledge about that institution, or you're coming in from outside, it becomes really relevant to get a sense of the climate of that institution. It does begin upstream, which is at the president's level, and if you have a chancellor, if you have a health system that is actually organized. So really to understand the organizational structure of the place and the climate to the extent that you can. If you're internal to that, it's maybe easier to understand the climate. And when I mean the climate, I mean how collaborative it is, how mission-oriented it is, what are the principles, what are the things that resonate with that chair's, you know, vision for pediatrics, whether they're a subspecialist, an academic generalist, you know, does it resonate with what their aspiration is for that leadership position. So that for me would be the key point. And then how does the fact that there's an interim dean or an acting dean anchor the basic supports that exist? Okay, and that takes a bit of an analysis, right? To say that there is a vision that is existing that will be part of the recruitment of that dean. For example, if there's an emphasis on basic science or an emphasis on NIH funding, what is the basic sort of tenor of that organization? And is that going to carry through in the recruitment of the dean? And ask those questions very explicitly. What will this mean? And then obviously devil in the details in terms of understanding if there is a real potential for this recruitment to succeed, what's codified in the offer letter that supports this incoming chair to succeed, and to be very concrete about the commitment. Now, we know commitments sometimes change, that there is a commitment, but then, and I've seen it in situations, not my own, but situations across the country where someone is recruited, and regardless of whether there's an interim or an acting dean, the conditions of that recruitment actually change. And no one can actually predict that. But to the extent that one can say, what's my reason for seeking this, for both personal and professional reason? Is it consistent with my view of where I want to take my own career and what I bring as a leader? Then I think you can't predict the future. That's the extent of the prediction. And that you make a decision as to whether this makes sense for you. Okay. And prepare for change in the way we all have to prepare for change.
I think that I would disagree with the saying that you have to be almost absolute in not taking a position when there's a change in leadership. But that includes if you're looking at a chair position, going for the dean, looking at a division chief, going for the chair, looking at a faculty, going for a member of the division. The saying that, you'd be yesterday's newspaper when the new leader comes in and you don't want to be in that position, I actually think doesn't really hold. I've seen many instances in which people have taken positions when the position above them is an interim or acting position and have actually been very successful. I think there are some things that if you're approaching a position in which the leadership position is interim or acting right above that position, there are some things that take on more importance than if that isn't the case. One of the things I always advise people to do that they don't often do is to talk to people who are in similar positions that they're looking at within the institution. So if you're looking at a chair position, you really want to talk with some of the other chairs in that institution and find out how the institution has done in terms of fulfilling commitments that they've made to them. Difficult situations and the support that they felt throughout the institution, not just the dean, but other ways that the institution supports the individual, relationships with the leadership of the hospital, perhaps the leadership of the health system, the leadership of the board, whatever. Those are probably just as important as the actual dean is going to be giving them in terms of their support.
One thing I think worth mentioning is, I think this is where mentorship or coaching or similar dynamic for the applicant is important as well. Helping them understand what their capacity will be in their ability to adapt to this new situation. There are some people who thrive in coming in and being a fireman or a firewoman, and they may be perfect and comfortable in a dynamic situation with a lot of uncertainty. There are others who are, more inclined to just build on what already exists there. And, so it's different skill sets and different personalities. So I think what might be a situation that I would recommend some people to stay away from, there might be others that I would encourage to go take a chance and see if they can make a big impact on the institution.
Having had the experience of recruiting a major recruit of a surgeon, I think one of the things that may be critical is to make sure that the infrastructure support when you're recruiting especially in interventionalists, that there is that team support is going to be very solid commitment, because it may, you know, and I'm thinking of cardiothoracic surgery, for example, that requires such a team effort that recruitment may be really critical, dependent on a very firm commitment of the organization. And it extends usually beyond the dean, it extends to the hospital system, et cetera, that commitment is firm, because that can make or break even the best surgeons if they don't have that support. So just add that piece.
You know, we've been focusing on that person you report to and depend on for your resource, but it's also really critical to think about the followers that you would have, and do they buy into your vision? Because if you come in, and even if you agree with the interim leader, but your vision is not a good sync, I mean, it's important to be sure you have the alignment both up and down, especially more important perhaps, or is equally important when there's a vacancy.
Yeah, I mean, I think there've been a lot of great comments made that, you know, doing your homework, looking through things, making sure, you know, the resources are there, the team is there, that all those other tangible parts of the position that attracts you to the place. It's not just the one person recruiting you. But having said that, I have had some experience where two major recruitments were done, and the individual who was in the permanent position, who had overseen the recruitments, announced their departure within weeks of these two new leaders, division directors arriving. And despite the fact that all of the checks and balances were in the position, they knew the scope of the job, they were excited about the team they were going to lead, they were very much attracted to the institution, they had all the infrastructure and resources, the trust that was lost when that was not disclosed to them before they arrived on campus was earth-shattering. So I think that, you know, sometimes there can just be one thing like that that could really derail a recruitment. And I remember being asked to kind of step in and try and reassure these candidates that, you know, their commitments were still strong, that, you know, everything that had been done to recruit them was going to come to fruition, that there was going to be a new chair that would have the same kind of commitment to them and the same kind of quality person and blah, blah, blah. But the sheer fear of the unknown was very real. So I think that, you know, if you're an interim, if you are a permanent and you're actually planning to step down during the midst of doing a major recruitment, in my experience, one of the most important things is the trusting communication that comes with putting the package together and, you know, developing a relationship, that in the event you step down, or in the event a new position is, you know, person is appointed, you know, all hands on deck are going out and reaffirming the commitments that have been made and the belief that this will be a good position for you. And even though that, you know, there's a change in leadership. So, you know, I think all the things we've said are true, but I do believe even when you're being recruited as a chair or a division chief, and there's a huge scope of responsibility, it's always a big move to leave an institution and to join a new institution. And we can never underestimate the impact of, you know, changes in leadership or unknowns that can really, you know, derail a really important candidate seeking a position.
Wesley, you've had years and years of experience in this arena. What are your thoughts?
That comment spurred a lot of thoughts from the last 25 years, because it's not uncommon that people are recruiting leaders while at the same time knowing that they're also thinking about leaving the organization. It's common that we have people looking at division director roles who are encouraged to stay by people who we also know are looking at other roles. And so it's really important that we all take the high road. If you are a candidate looking at an interim role, I definitely think you should leverage the opportunity to get outside the traditional recruiting processes of universities. And you know, we all know that even having health system people on search committees is uncommon, right? They tend to be university-based search committees. And so, you know, with an interim role, I think it gives the candidate the opportunity to ask to engage with people above, you know, the leadership role, to engage with people in the health system, to make sure that what you want to build and grow there is possible and that other people outside of just your immediate boss buy into your vision. Because, and the reality is, it may be a really stable situation, but with the transition realities, you almost have to approach it as if you are going to be reporting to an interim leader, because that may very well happen in your tenure at the institution. And so I think a lot of the things, but to your point, Valerie, the thing that I wanted to comment on specifically was if you are a leader and you're currently running searches that will report to you, but you also are thinking about a transition, I think it's a fiduciary responsibility on you to encourage the candidates as part of their interview experience to talk with the people you report to and to talk to people within the health system to share their vision, so that if you do in fact decide to leave the organization, you have, I think, done your fiduciary responsibility to connect them with those that are going to impact their career, you know, when that interim leader comes in your place. So a little bit of it on both sides of the equation, I think.
I would just reiterate a couple of points that have been made. The first is the culture and history of the institution. You can often tell if reporting to an interim person is going to be a problem by what's happened at that university with similar situations. And as someone said, it's critical, therefore, to talk to peers at that institution. So if you're interviewing for a chair position, talk to the other chairs and see what happened during their tenures. If you're a division director, talk to the other division directors and see how those transitions were previously handled. So history and culture, I think, are very important. On the other hand, really good opportunities don't come by every day. So if this is a position that you're looking at that you really believe could be a wonderful opportunity where you can really make a difference that will impact your field positively by your doing it, then it's worth looking at no matter whether or not the person will be an interim. So I think those are two key points in looking at positions under these circumstances.
Sometimes it's a commitment to that community, that particular community, and that dedication. So thank you, Arnie, for adding that. That was something that many of us have chosen to do this is because of commitment to improving child health, and it may be tied to specific communities and certain visions. So thanks. It's beyond money and infrastructure sometimes, although those are critical.
What's the role of the health system in the importance of leadership? And if there's turnover at the leadership at the health system, how's that influence candidates' views, do you think?
I think it's not terribly different than turnover within the department or within school of medicine. I think it's an opportunity for you as a candidate to, as we've mentioned, to talk to your peers and see, is there a pattern there? Is there something more systemic going on at the health system that you need to be aware of? It's not unusual to have turnover. I mean, that's part of the environment that we're in. And so a lot of times that turnover is a positive thing. Someone was promoted into another role, took a professional opportunity at another institution. There's a lot of very positive reasons why you could have turnover within the health system. But if the pattern is there and it consistently looks like there is turnover in that system, then it's worth digging deeper into that as a candidate and talking to potential peers, potential colleagues at the institution to get their feel for what is going on within the health system. You know, the one other thing I'll mention, Bruder, that I think is important is that whatever commitments are made during a recruitment need to be included as part of the offer letter. So particularly when you're being recruited by an interim leader, make sure that all of those details are in writing. I think it's incumbent upon you at that point and for the institution itself to put those type of commitments in writing so that nothing is left to chance. And I just think that's vitally important, sometimes overlooked, that the relationship will be strong enough to withstand any verbal discussion that was made. We often forget about, you know, those discussions or in what context they were made while we were being recruited. So I would just stress to make sure those details are done in writing.
One of the questions Brutus addressed of us is, what if there's been a lot of turnover? How would that be approached? And this has already been well described and discussed by a number of people, but to summarize, you want to know who is leaving, why have they left, and how will this affect me? Those are the three questions you need to ask. And they're interrelated. If the who is a group of senior leaders over a short period of time, you need to understand, were these planned retirements that were just coincidental, or is there another reason? If it was a group of younger faculty that have all left after some leadership changes, that's a different issue. As an example, if you've had a number of junior faculty leave because a consultant was brought in to change the practice plan, but the institution recognized this, backed away, set up another group to relook at this, that's very, very different than just having a loss of people. So that goes to the who, but it also goes to the why. Part of the why may be difficult to get your hands on, especially if you're interviewing for a position. I know of a place where there has been a significant amount of turnover, and each person there was said to have left, not because they were looking for a job, but they were recruited to the job of their lifetime. And if you hear this repeatedly for a group of different leaders, you begin to question why that occurred. One way potentially to approach this is, just as the university or the department that's recruiting you waits for your approval to reach out to your referees or referee other people to ask about you, it might be appropriate, if you reach that point where they're making that request of you, to say, would it have your permission to reach out to some of those who have left to find out more about the circumstances of their leaving? Just the response to that, affirmative or negative, may speak volumes. But the most important thing, and this was mentioned just now by John, I believe, was, how about will this really affect my position? Do I have concrete commitments? Are the people I'm reporting to, whether they're new or whether they're interim, will I really have the support to do the job? And is this something that I really would like to do, in spite of these changes, or recognizing what these changes represent?
I wanted to go back to something that John said, and I think I've shared this story with Bruder in the past, but early in my career, my mentor suggested that if I were ever offered a leadership position, that rather than getting detailed assurances about the support I would get for this, that, or the other thing, to rather get a commitment to the overall vision and to keep it higher level. His suggestion was that when you ask for a lot of minutiae, you end up then going back to them maybe years later, and they'll say, well, we've already given you everything we can give you. So I just wondered what the balance is between, you know, getting your assurances in writing. What do people think about, should that be at a you know, 10,000 foot level? Like, we agree that you're going to grow this division by expanding, you know, this component, or do you think it should get right down to, we're going to promise you X numbers of dollars to develop your program?
When I was recruiting, I always wanted to make sure that I matched the resources to the vision, with the understanding that a vision for a division could change over a 5 to 10 year period. So I think it's really incumbent upon you to try and figure out what that 5 year vision is, and then to adequately resource it, with that understanding that if we haven't adequately resourced it and things are going in the right direction and we're meeting and exceeding the metrics we set forward, that additional resources are going to come, understandably, with a successful leader who's successfully leading a group. So I kind of feel strongly that you do need to put the resources out and have the clarity, because it's part of having clarity Bob, on what the vision is and what the expectations are for that tenure. The comment that I was going to make, though, was related to the comments John made around, you know, make sure your commitments are all line itemed and everything is understood when you take a job, because if you're doing it with an interim, you know, you want everything in writing. And I would say that is obviously true. But again, I have seen examples in reviews that I've done of institutions. I've seen examples, sadly, in my own institution where commitments that were on paper were not honored. And so what I think you have to do when you're looking at these roles and responsibilities in a position where either the leadership is interim, or God forbid, the example I gave earlier with somebody being the person you're negotiating with and leaves in short order before you arrive, I think you have to look at the whole picture of the position, the people you'll lead, the vision that you want to embrace, and ask yourself, if any one of these things on my commitment letter went away, did the sum total of this opportunity, like Arnie was saying, does the sum total of this opportunity, even if that line item that says I'm getting an endowed chair goes away or whatever it is, would the position be any less enticing to you? And if the answer to that question is yes, and you believe you have enough trust that all those line item commitments will be realized, but you also have the reality check that if any one of them wasn't there, would you walk away from this opportunity? And if the answer to that question is no, then you're on the right course. Because I think, again, it's a reality check. People mean well, people put things in offer letters. Sometimes they make commitments that are actually above their pay grade and they don't have the authority to do it. And then you're left with, well, wait a minute, Joe Blow offered me this. It was in my letter, but you know, you have to give it, and you find out, well, he didn't have that authority. So, you know, I guess I'm just trying to not play the devil's advocate, but I'm trying to sort of say, like, even when everything's supposedly on a paper and been committed to, sometimes you just don't get everything that you wanted because of whatever circumstances. So make sure that that sum total of that position is really the most important thing in making you really want to aspire to taking that job.
I think adaptive leadership is a term that many of us have used, and to kind of balance those tensions. But the thing that made me smile in the discussion is that, you know, for many of us as leaders, it's our ability to create, you know, to bring ourselves to a position. And yes, there may be some things that are non-negotiable, for example, you know, promotion, et cetera. But when I entered my position as a division chief, I had no endowed chair planned. And within a year, I got that because I got 3 federal grants. And they said, oh, we wake up. Okay. So I think the challenge and the love of what we do and that creativity and what the mission is in accomplishing, of course, it's a balance to really, this is a business, to take a look at, you know, what's promised and what's genuinely needed for support. But I do think we bring our creativity to it, and our ability to adapt to situations to make it a success, even in the face of challenges. So I'm really building on what Valerie and others have said, but I think that innovative spirit needs to be part of any leadership, accepting any leadership position.
This has been a terrific discussion. I had exactly what Valerie said happened to someone. It happened to me, the person who recruited me when I came to buy my home 3 months before I was to take my first position and was going to guide me in my developing a new research technique, told me that he was leaving. And my chair protected me and helped me get through that very, very difficult transition. So it's really important for people to be helpful, because you want someone to take an opportunity, but the person who takes the opportunity needs to establish a protective cocoon for the person that's coming in, if that's going to be the case, and to be honest and upfront. The principles that people brought out was that it's really important to developed a level of trust with the institution and to explore the history and culture of the institution by what previous leaders have experienced, what your peer chairs have experienced, and if there's a lot of turnover, to understand, is that due to strategic decisions, or is it due to chaos and dysfunctional organization? And that how important it is not only to be able to define your resources that will allow you to reach your vision, but also to understand if that vision is compatible with where the institution is going and has gone, and where the and how important it is that your vision meet and have the support of the department and the community, so that it's that the opportunity is clearly worth the risk of uncertainty. Because most people, if you're succeeding, they support you. it's important that you know how, if you can succeed with your vision, and then no matter who's on top will generally support you. So those were all great points today. Thank you, Wesley and John, for your insights. And if I encourage people to look at other Insight Conversations on the Career Physician website. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for today's discussion. If you have a question for our council or have a future topic suggestion, please connect with us at pediatricinsight.com. The Child Health Advisory Council is comprised of a diverse group of emeritus deans, department chairs, division chiefs, and child health executives recognized for their leadership contributions in academic pediatrics and child health. The CHAC's impact is further bolstered by council specialty advisors who are active current national leaders in each of the subspecialties in pediatrics. Collectively, the 30 plus members of the CHAC bring unmatched wisdom and experience to career physicians' executive search and leadership development endeavors for its clients. Our council members include the following physicians: Bruder Stapleton, Christine Gleason, Craig Hillemeyer, Renee Jenkins, Danielle LaRocque Arena, Valerie Opapari, Bruce Rubin, Robert Sawin, and Arnold Strauss. To view our council members' bios, please visit careerphysician.com and click on the Child Health Advisory Leadership tab.